Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. I've never really focused on Holocaust videos because I've had things to discuss that I thought were more important, and there were lots of people already busy doing good Holocaust work, and in fact excellent Holocaust work, exposing the lies about the Jewish Holocaust of World War II, where they claim that 6 million Jews were killed by the Germans. But make no mistake, years ago when I started waking up to this Jewish issue, I actually began to dig into this matter quite intensively for a couple of years, and I watched every Holocaust video that I could lay my hands on. And I want to tell you that there's tons of stuff to look at. In fact, one could spend almost months, easily, we could spend months doing nothing but looking at and discussing Holocaust claims by Jews. We could spend months and months and months looking at various things, discussing it, and you would see how people have been hoodwinked, how people in the West have been lied to and have fallen for enormous lies. But as I look around and I read and I do things, I do stumble onto things from time to time which I think are important. And previously I did do one Holocaust related video. It was about Canadian film footage that was shown on Canadian TV, where there was an attorney. Some of you may know the amazing Canadian attorney Doug Christie, a truly admirable and incredible white man. And Doug Christie was a guy who defended Ernst Zundel in Canada regarding the issue of the Holocaust. Anyway, Doug Christie was on TV, and the TV presenter then debated him somewhat about the Holocaust. And then the TV presenter said, "Well, just to show all of you that the Holocaust is real, you know, here's some film footage." And he showed film footage, and you saw all these corpses, all these dead bodies lying around a train. And then he said, "Well, that's to show you that the Holocaust was real." And I went and did an entire video about that film footage. I did a whole video about it because those corpses that you are seeing there, those are not Jews. Those are not dead Jews. Those are most likely dead Germans. But I did a whole video and I explained and I showed the footage and I showed various other things to show people that you've just been lied to. Anyway, quite some time ago, I was looking through some books that I had and I came upon a story, a Holocaust story that I'd never heard of before. And the Holocaust story is Babi Yar, and it's near Kiev in Russia. So I decided, well, let me read this story and let me take a look at this. And of course it was by a British author, etc. So it was going to be the normal thing of, oh well, here are those nasty evil Nazis and they went and they killed these Jews, etc. But I thought, let me read it anyway and just take a look at it, you know, maybe there's something of interest, something I'll remember, whatever. And while I was reading this thing, at a point I got to a certain part in the story and I said to myself, that's a little bit strange. There's something a bit strange over there. That doesn't look right to me. Because the whole story was very plausible, except for certain thing in the story. And I was saying to myself, but that doesn't sound right. Now I wonder if that is physically possible. And then I did more thinking, and I thought, you know, there's something really problematic at that point in the story. And I did more research, and I spoke to another friend of mine who's familiar with weapons, and then we saw, there's a big problem there, actually. In the middle of this very plausible story, there's something that's really problematic. And out of the entire story, that was the part that really hit me in the face. So, in this video, we're going to take a look at this story. We're going to look at exactly that same story, and I'll show you what it was that bothered me. And we're going to take a real close look at this, and then you sit back afterwards and you ask yourself a question: how real was this entire thing? Because this thing is acknowledged as a real event, but you're going to see some things, and we're going to sit and ponder a few things. And did this actually really take place? Now, the other thing that you've got to remember about World War II is the greatest conflict in human history, and I grew up in Rhodesia, in what had been a British colony, and I went to school at a school named after Winston Churchill. In fact, they were very proud that this school was the first school outside of Britain that was named after Winston Churchill. So you must know, I went to school at Churchill High School in then Salisbury, Rhodesia, and in our hall we had photographs of these young Spitfire pilots from the Battle of Britain who had died fighting these evil Germans. And we even had a tiny little room in the back of the hall that was like a miniature museum, a miniature Churchill museum with various things to do with Winston Churchill. So in my formative teenage years, you must know, I was inundated with all this pro-British stuff in Rhodesia, even though at that point in time we were rebelling against Britain. But even then, we still stuck to the storyline. Britain was good, Britain was good. Evil Nazis, terrible people, horrible, horrible murderers and liars, big liars, lying German scum, and so forth. So I grew up believing all this junk. I watched things like The World at War. I got the World at War series. I watched every single episode at least twice, if not three times. I've seen it all. Okay, I've seen all the British propaganda about the Germans, all the stuff, including stuff where they were saying, "Oh, those death camps." I've watched it all. But much later, when I started waking up, I began to realize, oh man, there is another side to World War II that you were never told. There's a whole other side. And I'll tell you that World War II is unquestionably the most lied about event in all of human history. And of course, in some respects, it stands to reason because it was the greatest conflict ever. The only problem is that we believe that we were on the right side. And then you begin to discover that, hold on, there's a whole ton of things that you didn't hear about. There are lots and lots of things that Germans told and did and have evidence for that you were just never introduced to. And the more you begin looking at that, the more you begin to realize, oh man, the lies are insane. And guess what? The lies are actually largely on our side, the good side. We are the ones who have been inundated with more lies than you can believe. That when you get to look at this thing in its true perspective, you begin to realize, oh man, we've really been lied to on a scale that is shocking. This photo is from the Nuremberg trials at the end of World War II. And the Nuremberg trials are themselves a travesty of justice on a massive scale. And a lot of Germans were hanged as a result of the junk that came out of those trials. Anyway, the key person in this event that you see here in this photograph is this lady who's giving testimony. That woman there, her name is Dina Pronicheva, and she is Jewish, and she is the original source for the claim that the Germans were slaughtering people at Babi Yar. She is the original survivor, in fact. And it's her story that we're going to take a close look at in this video, because she tells the story of how the Germans were machine gunning people into pits and how she managed to survive to tell the tale. And that is the thing that we're really going to be interested in. Because from her story and her stuff, everything else then grows bigger and bigger. And you'll see the extent to which this Babi Yar story is taken seriously. This is a photo of George Bush at the Babi Yar Memorial. This photo comes from the book where I was reading the story of Babi Yar. So here is a president of the United States at this memorial, and he's talking whatever stuff he's saying, probably saying, oh, these things must never happen again, blah, blah, blah. Evil Germans, Nazis, never again must this happen, etc. But anyway, so this is him at this memorial. So this is a serious memorial to an apparent event. And here are more photos of this. Here you can see this Jewish symbol. And you can see all these people, probably large numbers of them are Jews, and they're all busy laying wreaths and flowers in memory of these people who were slaughtered by those evil Germans at Babi Yar. And here you can see probably little Russian boys and girls all standing there at this same memorial where George Bush was, also with all these tributes to the dead Jews. And again, those evil, evil Nazis. And here you can see a Jewish guy also laying his flowers in memory of this horrible, horrible event. So the bottom line is that there's a proper memorial here. Serious people come here from around the world, even presidents, to come to remember this incident where these Nazis were gunning these Jews into pits. Now, an important aspect of this story is that the Jewish stories about the Holocaust themselves are filled with all kinds of contradictions. And the contradictions just become more and more insane the more you look at it. So you find that on the one hand, you had these Germans who were capable of building tanks, aircraft. They could do all kinds of engineering, feats of engineering, and they are known for their efficiency and their ability to come up with methods to do things. And you see, whatever the Germans do, that you see a certain kind of approach. You see that they do high quality stuff, and they're very consistent, very disciplined, very organized. And by the way, this extends into their record keeping, by the way. The Germans are also very, very excellent at record keeping of everything they do. So when you get to the Holocaust, you suddenly find that German record keeping is non-existent, and you suddenly find that the behavior of the Germans is very different to the behavior that you normally attribute to Germans. That suddenly the Germans are inconsistent, and the Germans here do this, and the Germans over there do that, and the Germans here do things this way, and it just goes on. You suddenly find that German behavior, as told by the Jews, is now something very different to what you've seen before. That now Germans are very inconsistent, and you suddenly can't find things, and this thing clashes with that thing. And this to me is a sign that we have a problem, but maybe the problem is not a German problem. Maybe the real problem is a Jewish problem. And another thing about these Holocaust things, once you start digging into them, is that you will find that they tell all kinds of stories. Well, at this place, they killed so many million, and they did it in this way, and so on. And then, if you go and you see what those places are like now, and you go and look at the original stories, and you look at what the Germans had at the time in that place, then you also find there's a serious problem here. That there are claims that couldn't have happened physically in those places. A good example is Treblinka. At Treblinka, they say that the Germans killed 900,000 to a million Jews. But go and see what is there at Treblinka, and Treblinka is nothing more than a tiny railway station, and there are no buildings there. And there was one little building. And they tell you, no, here at Treblinka, they killed a million people, and a million people are buried over there in that field. But a big thing with all these Jewish stories is that despite the massive scale of things that they claim, the fact of the matter is there's no physical evidence. There is a whole lack of evidence of these millions of dead people. So you have scientists who can go and grab a bone from an ancient human that's 5,000 years old, or an entire skeleton of somebody from 5,000 years ago, even 9,000 years ago, whole pieces of skeletons of people from 9,000 years ago, and they can study them. Oh, this was an adult. This was an adult. This person had a spear injury, which they recovered from. Oh, there's a bone from a human being or a pre-human being that's 2 million years old. So you'll find, if you look at archaeology, you'll find there's tons and tons and tons of stuff. That here are these scientists and digging up dinosaurs, and they tell you, oh, this was a mammal that lived 200 million years ago, blah, blah, blah. Here was a human that lived so many thousands of years ago, and we extracted some DNA from that person. We can tell you stuff. We can even tell you see that guy who died 5,000 years ago? Do you know, we know what he was eating at the time that he died. You know, all these kinds of facts are sitting in science. Then you get to the Jewish Holocaust, where 6 million Jews apparently died during World War II. And suddenly you find yourself with 6 million dead Jews and no autopsies. No autopsies, none. Nobody's ever dug those Jews out of the ground. Because if they had been able to get to them, if you know that somebody died in a specific place, because that's the other thing about the Jewish Holocaust, is they're very specific. They tell you, okay, at this place, you know, 4 million Jews died. At that place, 1 million died. At that place, 800,000 died, and so on. They tell you a whole stack of people died over there in that area, in that small area. Well, that's easy. That's easy. You just go and get yourself some archaeologists and you just start digging, man. And you'll start digging into the ground. You'll find stuff. Now, if you go and you look at archaeology, for example, you'll see that in ancient ruins that exist, that they can tell you, well, we found the rubbish heaps of those ancient people. And we found the things that they throw out on their rubbish heaps. And so the scientists study the rubbish heaps and they say, in this heap of rubbish we found that they are eating this kind of food. We found the remains of those shells. They must be eating those kinds of fish, and so on and so forth. So even if it's just a rubbish heap, scientists love it. They go and they dig through it and they find this rubbish heap and they start telling you, oh man, there's this thing and that thing and that thing and that thing. There's tons of stuff. Now, in the case of these Jews, in the days when David Irving still told the truth, which is unfortunately he's deviated from that these days, but in the days when David Irving told the truth, he raised some of the issues about the Holocaust, and he said things like, the average human body is about 60 kilos, 60 kilograms. So, you know, if you've killed 6 million people, then you've actually got 360,000 tons of flesh and bone. 360,000 tons of flesh and bone. So getting rid of that flesh and bone, even if you cremate it, even if you go and you burn the bodies and you crush the bones, because you can't burn the bones, eh? even if you take it and you do this and you do that and you do this and you do that to it, the fact of the matter is you've still got some kind of residue, even if it's crushed, pulverized bone and ashes. Even that stuff, you have got something physical there. And if you had hundreds of tons of that lying in a place, which you should have thousands of tons. You know, let's take Treblinka. If they killed, say, 1 million or 900,000 Jews at Treblinka of some kind of residue, there's got to be something there. So even if you had to dig through the soil, you should find little fragments of bones and things. And scientists do this stuff all the time. They sit and they quietly dig through things and they find tiny little things and they assemble it. Even if you had little fragments of bones, you could subject it to all kinds of studies. You could say, this is a bone. This person died 75 years ago. Let's see if we can find some DNA, blah, blah, blah. There's all kinds of things. Even if you just had, you know, burnt remains, you should be able to dig there and even say, well, you see, there are these layers of soil here. And, there seems to be a lot of activity in 1941 and then less activity in 42, but more activity, you know, you should be able to come to some kind of conclusion. But you will find with this story that you will really struggle. You'll really struggle with this Holocaust. You've got these claims of large numbers of killings, but you'll really battle. You'll really battle when it comes to the evidence story. Now, in this case, in this particular case, at Babi Yar, again, like I've said, the Jews are inconsistent in their descriptions of the Germans. So in some places the Germans do this, in other places the Germans do that. But at Babi Yar, the story actually sounds plausible, because at Babi Yar, the Germans just shoot people into pits, very much like the Jewish Bolsheviks did in the Soviet Union, the original Soviet Union. There, the NKVD came and shot people in the head, shot people into pits, etc. So if you really want to kill people, that's the way to do it. That's the simplest way to do it, the cheapest method. You dig a hole, or get them to even dig a hole, and then you shoot them into the hole, and you can just bulldoze it shut, and that's that. That's actually the simple way to do it. That's how literally every single attempt at genocide has been done in the world. It's been done something along those lines. People are shot. In other cases, in other countries where there have been genocides, people are shot, they fall into rivers. In other places, people are killed, they lie out there in the fields. They don't even bother to bury them and burn them. But in the Jewish Holocaust, you hear about all this killing, and then when you want to go looking for actual evidence, then suddenly you find that now there's a struggle to find those remains. That millions have died, and yet there are no real places where scientists have gone. To my knowledge, as far as I know, I don't know of a single autopsy from World War II of dead Jews. I don't know of a single autopsy. And I definitely don't know of any scientific studies where scientists have gone to a place, dug there, and gone and studied the actual Holocaust, because that should be easily possible. It should be very easily possible, especially since you know the places where it happened. So you know it happened in that geographical area. And it's not like it's 1,000 kilometers by 1,000 kilometers. It's a much smaller area. It's a tiny area. And another thing that also complicates matters is that you also have Allied aircraft and various aircraft flying over these areas during the time of their apparent killings. And do you know that there's not a single aerial photograph from World War II showing any of these killings taking place, though American and British and other aircraft were flying over areas photographing them at the time when some of these things were supposedly taking place. So suddenly when it gets to the hard evidence, suddenly it's a real struggle. But in this case, this particular one sounds very doable because they're shooting people. So it doesn't have all the other weird complications that come from all the other variations of stories. This story initially sounds solid. It sounds solid because it's very straightforward. However, you're going to see that, as with so many of these stories, that the Jewish physics does not quite match up with the reality. I just want to show you the book that I'm going to be reading from. It's called The World's Worst Atrocities. This was a second-hand book that I picked up quite a number of years ago. and it's been lying around. And then I decided, let me just browse through this thing, see if there's anything useful in here. Is there anything that refers to Jews? So this is the front cover. Of course, guess who's the worst guy of all? Worst guy of all, Adolf Hitler. Worst man, most evil man, apparently. But that's just bullshit. And it's a book printed in Britain. You can see £2. So anyway, so that's what the book looks like. And I just want to show you how recent this is. It says this 1999 edition. And it's been reprinted in 2002. Reprinted in 2002. So this is modern. This is modern. And it says printed and bound in Great Britain. So it's a modern book. And here's the table of contents. All various slaughters that took place. But the one that we're interested in here, by the way, they even mentioned Dresden. So even a few words about the Germans getting killed. But other than that, we've got the main one we're interested in is Babij Yar. And it's chapter 15, page 127. And just to show you, this is here in World's Worst Atrocities. Here's one of the pages regarding the story. There you can see George Bush, President George Bush, speaking in front of the Holocaust Memorial in Kiev of Babij Yar. So there you've got it. Now, World War II also had lots and lots of lies, and they came from the Allies. You've been misled into believing that the Germans were the liars of World War II, but if you really study it closely, you'll discover the horrific truth is actually the opposite. So I just want to discuss a little bit of this because you'll see the importance of this. There are three types of propaganda. There's white propaganda, grey propaganda, and black propaganda. And black propaganda, in a nutshell, is really the art of lying. This is what it boils down to, really. So let's take a look at Wikipedia. Let's see what the official definition is. And it says, black propaganda is a form of propaganda intended to create the impression that it was created by those it is supposed to discredit. Black propaganda contrasts with grey propaganda, which does not identify its source, and white propaganda, which does not disguise its origins at all. It is typically used to vilify or embarrass the enemy through misrepresentation. In other words, lying. The major characteristic of black propaganda is that the audience are not aware that someone is influencing them and do not feel that they are being pushed in a certain direction. Black propaganda purports to emanate from a source other than the true source. This type of propaganda is associated with covert psychological operations. In other words, they're messing with your head. Sometimes the source is concealed or credited to a false authority and spreads lies, fabrications, and deceptions. Black propaganda is the big lie, including all types of creative deceit. Black propaganda relies on the willingness of the receiver to accept the credibility of the source. If the creators or senders of the black propaganda message do not adequately understand their intended audience, The message may be misunderstood, seem suspicious, or fail altogether. Let me just pause there. The problem with propaganda is that if you get it wrong, then it could just go over the people's head and not have any effect at all. But if you do it right, it'll have a big impact. Governments conduct black propaganda for reasons that include A, by disguising their direct involvement, a government may be more likely to succeed in convincing an otherwise unbelieving target audience. So let me pause there. If you know it comes from the enemy, then you know, oh God, they're lying. So you hide the fact that it's coming from you. That's very important. And B, there are diplomatic reasons behind the use of black propaganda. Black propaganda is necessary to obfuscate a government's involvement in activities that may be detrimental to its foreign policies. So they can create propaganda, you won't even know it's propaganda, and it's coming to you like it's true, like it's believable. But it can be a bunch of lies, a bunch of nasty, malicious lies, but it's intended to fool you. It's intended to mess with your head. That's the key. So here's a name that not many people know about World War II, and the name is Sefton Delmer. So who is Sefton Delmer? So here on Wikipedia it says Dennis Sefton Delmer was a Jewish-British journalist of Australian heritage and propagandist for the British government during World War II. Fluent in German, because it seems he was born in Germany, he became friendly with Ernst Röhm, who arranged for him to interview Adolf Hitler in 1931. During hostilities, he led a black propaganda campaign against Hitler by radio from England, so successfully that he was named in the Nazis' Black Book for immediate arrest after their planned invasion of Britain. In other words, Sefton Delmer was the top official liar for the British government, and he was a Jew. So here's a quote from Sefton Delmer. So there is Sefton Delmer there, and so here's a quote from him. And this is what he said to a German professor. This was after 1945. Atrocity propaganda is how we won the war. And we're only really beginning with it now. So, just hold on a second. This is after the Germans have surrendered. And he says, and we're only really beginning with it now. We will continue this atrocity propaganda. We will escalate it until nobody will accept even a good word from the Germans. Until all the sympathy they may still have abroad will have been destroyed, and they themselves will be so confused that they will no longer know what they are doing. Once that has been achieved, once they begin to run down their own country and their own people, not reluctantly but with eagerness to please the victors, only then will our victory be complete. It will never be final. Then he continues, re-education needs careful tending, like an English lawn. Even one moment of negligence and the weeds crop up again. Those indestructible weeds of historical truth. So this was said by Sefton Delmer, former chief of black propaganda, and it was said after the German surrender in 1945 in a conversation with the German professor of international law, Dr. Friedrich Grimm. So just note in here where he says, until all the sympathy they may still have abroad will have been destroyed. But listen to this. And they themselves will be so confused that they will no longer know what they are doing. Once that has been achieved, once they begin to run down their own country and their own people, not reluctantly, but with eagerness to please the victors, only then will our victory be complete. It will never be final. And then he points out that you got to go back and screw with their heads again and again, because the big danger is the truth. The truth is going to come out again. So this is the master, the British master of lies of World War II. And he wasn't alone in inventing lies about the Germans. I've done other videos about how the British got the Americans to hate the Germans. That was a separate issue. Britain did a lot of lying in World War II. And this was lying that was aimed at the enemy. Though I will tell you, the British even lied to their own people. And I even know of instances where the British were lying even to their own bomber Air Force pilots. But the British told lots and lots of lies, stacks of them. And those lies have become the truth. But the important thing here from Sefton Delmer, that's a takeaway, not only is this aimed at the Germans, but you should also look at this with respect to all white people, that you could easily have a type of black propaganda that exists to this day that comes at white people, all white people, and that you have this black propaganda that is aimed at confusing you and turning you against your own. You must never forget that these things are totally possible. So let's get cracking with the actual section that I'm going to be reading. So I'm going to read the entire chapter, and I'm going to try not to comment, especially regarding the really important thing. See if you can spot the problem in Jewish physics, because that's what happens with all these Holocaust stories, is that these Jews are inventing lies and they're trying to make it as believable as possible, and so they use the situation, etc., etc., and they make up their stories, but you'll find that all the Jewish Holocaust lies eventually start floundering on physics and logic. Now, in this case, the Germans are shooting the Jews, which, like I've said, is the most logical and reasonable thing to do. Just as the communists, when they were killing people, they were shooting lots of people into pits, except for the Holodomor, where they starved millions of white peasants to death. But anyhow, the point is that in military stuff, if you want to kill people, you kill them with normal weapons. So in the case of Rwanda with the blacks, they're busy cutting up other blacks. But in a war of this kind, you would expect people to be shot, because that is the best tool for the job. It is a tool designed to kill. So in that sense, Babi Yar is actually much more logical than the other junk stories, than the gassing and electrocution and all those other junk stories. Babi Yar, in that sense, makes more sense. That's what you'd want to do. That if you want to go and get rid of lots of people, you take them and you shoot them into pits, and then that's that. So the entire thing, when I was reading it, the entire thing seemed, yeah, this is plausible, this is plausible. And then at a point I said to myself, but hold on, did I read that? That's a little bit strange. And so that's all that I'm going to tell you, is that somewhere in the story is something a little bit weird. See if you can spot it. I'm going to read the whole story. See if you can spot it. No doubt thousands or tens of thousands of people have read this book, and they've read it and they've believed it. And I'll show you that what's in this book is quite consistent with what is out there, and that this is not some weird version of events. This is what the original story seems to be. So let me see how much I can read without commenting too much, but I will deliberately avoid the key issue. And you see if you can spot the error of Jewish physics that then causes you to say, did this ever really happen? So let's get cracking on it. Chapter 15, Bar B'Yar, page 127. So it says, there is a ravine outside Kiev, capital of the Ukraine, called Babi Yar. In 1941, the Nazis butchered 200,000 Jews there. So in this book, it says unequivocally, 200,000 Jews died in this ravine. So again, it's a ravine. So can't be that impossible to find the location where these people were apparently killed. Anyway, if anyone had ever had any doubt as to Hitler's intentions towards the Jewish people, it was dispelled by the atrocity at Babi Yar. The other thing that's probably valid in here is that they cite 1941 instead of 1942. Because I think all the gassing stuff from Auschwitz, that is normally 1942, etc. So it may even be that this is one of the earlier instances of those Germans just killing the Jews. Anyway, let's continue. When the Germans marched into Kiev on 19 September 1941, many Ukrainians rejoiced. It was the end of the Soviet-Russian rule. Since the Soviets took over in 1919, the Ukraine had been decimated by collectivization, purges, and famine. Even the Jews welcomed the Nazis. Well, that's an interesting one. So in this book, they claim that the Jews welcomed the Nazis. Anyway, let's continue. The Soviet newspapers had carried not a word about Nazi atrocities right up until Hitler's sudden attack in June 1941. The Soviet press had heaped praise on Stalin's ally, Hitler. Nothing was said of the treatment of Jews in Germany and Poland. Some Jews even praised Hitler for being an able statesman. So let me just pause there. It does appear that the whole thrust of this thing is that this must be the first time ever that the Nazis showed their evil side. This then, I assume, is the first time those Nazis got down to the business of just killing those Jews, okay? So that seems to be the thrust of this thing. The older people recalled that when the Germans had been in the Ukraine in World War I, they had behaved very well, much better than the Russians. They had not been anti-Semitic then. The Germans were civilized Europeans with a respect for order. Most of all, they were renowned for their consistency. Soon, the Ukrainian Jews would discover, tragically, how wrong they were. When the Germans entered the city, they headed straight for Kreschatyk. This was the main street in Kiev, where the party officials and secret policemen lived and worked. Naturally, these officials had already departed. The Germans set up their headquarters there, taking over the Continental Hotel and converting the Doctors' Club into a club for German officers. Germans filled the boulevard cafes, two enterprising Jewish barbers set up shop and did a roaring trade cutting German officers' hair. The first ominous note was sounded when the Germans took over the radio station, page 128. All Jews working there were ordered out. On 24 September, the new boss of the radio station was just telling those remaining that he wanted the world to hear the voice of Free Kiev, when there was a massive explosion. The German headquarters had blown up. Explosions continued for the next 5 days, setting alight the center of Kiev. Nobody knows how many Germans were killed. Neither the Nazis nor the Soviets would say. Long after the war, the Soviets denied blowing up Kreschatyk, blaming it on the Germans. However, it is clear now that the Soviet authorities mined the whole area before leaving. A few soldiers had been left behind to detonate the bombs, but word quickly spread that the Jews were to blame. Okay, so here we can see the precursor now. All I will say here is that the German army ran into lots of what is known as partisan activity, that is guerrilla activity, and they hunted down the partisans, and this is normal in warfare, and these are people operating in some cases behind enemy lines, in which case the rules of war are that you can shoot them. But clearly there is some military activity going on. And it says here, but words quickly spread that the Jews were to blame. See, what we don't know is we don't know what the evidence is, because I will bet you that the soldiers and the military had evidence. Soldiers don't just say things. They don't just jump to conclusions. But anyway, this is true in any war. But anyway, so here now the notion is, the Jews are innocent, the Jews are innocent. But what is acknowledged is that Germans have already been killed. On the morning of 28 September, a notice went up. It said in Russian, Ukrainian and German, all Yids living in the city of Kiev and its vicinity are to report by 8 o'clock on the morning of Monday, 29 September 1941, at the corner of Melnikovsky and Doktorov streets near the cemetery. They are to take with them documents, money, valuables, as well as warm clothes, underwear, etc. Any Yid not carrying out this instruction and who is found elsewhere will be shot. Any civilian entering flats evacuated by Yids and stealing property will be shot. Ukrainians assumed that the Jews were being deported to Palestine, possibly as a reprisal for the Kreschatyk. Most Jews thought so too and did what they were told. The following morning, the streets near the cemetery were full of women and children, the sick and the elderly. All able-bodied young men had already been conscripted into the Red Army. These were poor people too. Anyone with enough money to leave Kiev was long gone. Some had even managed to bribe their way out of the city after it had been occupied. Many Ukrainians had no great love for the Jews. Some hurled insults at them, others called for them to be confined in a ghetto. Some Jews already feared that they were going to their deaths. One woman had poisoned herself and her children. A young girl had thrown herself from an upper story window. Her body lay in the street, covered by a sheet. Nobody bothered to remove it. Let me pause here. This is true, and one day I will do another video and I will deal with the issue of how Jews were really killed in World War II. And I can tell you that if you really want to know about Jews being killed, Jews were actually killed by the Ukrainian civilians. I'm not kidding you. Ukrainian civilians, and very possibly even other European civilians, but Ukrainian civilians definitely, they killed Jews before the Germans even arrived. I'm not joking with you. That is a fact. So it's even possible that the Ukrainians may already have turned around and started helping the Germans, telling them who did what, etc. You see, when you're a soldier and you're in war, you're also picking up intelligence from the locals. All these things are the way wars really work. And the mere fact that this girl has committed suicide and nobody's bothering to touch it, that might already be a sign that the Ukrainians are very irritated with the Jews and they just don't give a shit. So let's continue. The crowd moved off, a rumor having circulated that they were heading for the railway station. People carried suitcases. Some seemed to have the entire contents of their houses strapped to their backs. Others had clubbed together to hire a lorry to carry their possessions. The Russians and Ukrainians were not universally hostile to the Jews. Some had come to see old friends off, while others helped them with their bags. German soldiers looked on, keeping an eye out for pretty Jewish girls. Yeah, I'm sure. The German soldiers never raped women in World War II. I've never come across one instance of German soldiers raping women. And I will tell you that the local women were often very happy to be in the arms of the Germans. The Germans had no shortage of women. The women came to the Germans. Don't be fooled by any of this junk. The dense crowd edged along until they got to the cemetery. The entrance was guarded by German soldiers and Ukrainian policemen, who told the crowd that anyone who entered would not be allowed back, with the exception of cabbies, who could drop their fare and go back for another one. Jews were separated from non-Jews, husbands from wives. Still, most assumed that they were being taken to a train. There was a war on, and they were being evacuated to somewhere safer. The Jews were going first. They reasoned because they were more closely related ethnically to the Germans than the Russians or Ukrainians. Once inside the cemetery, everyone was told to drop what they were carrying. Foodstuffs on the right, baggage on the left. They would have to sort things out when they got to their destination. By now, they could hear the occasional burst of machine gun fire nearby, but could not admit to themselves that they were going to be shot. Let me just point out here the mention of machine gun fire. So we must keep that in the back of our minds. Machine guns. For one thing, there was such an enormous mass of people. Such things did not happen they told themselves. By the time they realized what was happening, it was too late. They found themselves walking through a narrow corridor lined by soldiers and dogs. Soldiers stood shoulder to shoulder, had their sleeves rolled up, and were armed with clubs and sticks. Let me just pause there. See, there is already something that's bothering me. This is something else, but the soldiers armed with clubs and sticks. I've read a lot of military literature, and I must tell you that I find it hard to believe that soldiers who've got proper weapons, and they've got proper weapons, they've got everything they need. They've got rifles, they've got knives, they've even got shovels. And let me tell you something. Do you know you can kill somebody with a shovel? I have read about this especially in World War I, where men used shovels to cut other men's heads off. So here is a soldier, he's got a rifle, he's got a knife, he's possibly even got a pistol maybe, but he's at least got a rifle, a knife, and a shovel. Unquestionably, those German soldiers carried a shovel. Why would he go and look for a stick and a club? And I live in Africa, and in Africa, the blacks have used clubs, and they made clubs. I know what a club looks like. I must tell you, I find it very hard to believe that men would be armed with a club. A club is not something you just pick up off the side of a road. A club is something you have to actually make. If you really wanted to have a wooden weapon, you could go and cut off a branch and you could have some sticks. Yes, you could have some stick that you could hit someone with. But a club, I find that hard to believe. You can't just cut a stick off, you can't just cut a branch off a tree and then suddenly you have a club. A club is something that you make. A club is something that's specific. Where would they find clubs? No, I find that hard to believe, that professional soldiers who have got actual weapons would suddenly go and get sticks and clubs and start creating other things or making clubs in the meantime. Find that hard to believe, really. I find that a stretch of the imagination. Because that soldier has his weapons and he knows how to use his weapons. He can do what he needs to do. If he needs to hit somebody, he will be able to use one of his weapons. Whether he hits someone with his rifle butt or he does something else or he pulls out that shovel of his, he'll be able to kill you with his shovel. He will be able to stab you if he wants to stab you. I find it very hard to believe that soldiers would suddenly go and be cutting off branches and now they're fashioning clubs. You wouldn't even be able to make a club in a day. To actually manufacture a club is a lot of work. So let's continue. As the crowd passed through, the soldiers beat them savagely, aiming for the ribs, the stomach, and the groin, drawing blood. Those who fell to the ground were set upon by the dogs and trampled by those coming from behind. Now there's another thing. If the Germans have dogs, and maybe they do have dogs, I find it hard to believe that there would be many of them, because dogs are not used regularly in warfare. Maybe certain units have got dogs, maybe for sniffing things out or for doing something else, but I don't think there'd be that many dogs around. Anyway, let's continue. Young women were propositioned by German soldiers who said that they could save them if they slept with them. Let me tell you, I find that a stretch of the imagination. Find that a real stretch of the imagination. Let's continue. Ukrainian policemen then ordered everyone to strip. Those who hesitated had their clothes ripped off them. They were still being kicked and hit with knuckle dusters and clubs by the Germans, who seemed to be in a sadistic frenzy. Let me stop there. Where do the knuckle dusters come from? I don't know of any soldiers who carry knuckle dusters with them. You'd have to show me examples of World War II soldiers carrying knuckle dusters. I find that really hard to believe. But anyway, let's continue. This was being done to keep the huge mass of people disorientated. So let me also say something else here. So how many German soldiers were there? If the German army arrived in Kiev, how many German soldiers actually arrived in Kiev in that short period of time? Because if they're talking about a totally enormous crowd, then the question is, it sounds like this crowd is being surrounded by soldiers. Are there enough soldiers to actually surround the crowd and to physically beat them? But anyway, let's continue. But these are questions that need to be asked, though. Anyway, let's continue. Bleeding naked people formed lines at a gap that had been dug in the steep wall of sand. Some Ukrainians who got mixed up with the Jews stood to one side there, but an officer ordered that they be shot anyway. He was afraid that if word got out of what was happening, no Jews would turn up the next day. Let me just pause here. In this particular story, if you look at what's being said here, it's as if the author knows what the Germans are thinking. The author is telepathic or able to go back in time and tell you, well, you see, this German was afraid that the word would get out and that no Jews would come back the next day. Where is any kind of evidence to back up anything like that? But anyhow, I just want to point out that there's lots of stuff here where they speak as if the Germans had told them certain things, as if this author has got some knowledge directly of this. I don't know the source where he's getting it from. It could be from a book written by a Russian. It's possible that this is a version of something that was written in more detail because there is a book that this story does come from. So this might be a shortened version of what actually is written in another book. Anyway, let's continue. The lines of naked people were marched through into the ravine and lined up on a narrow ledge in the quarry. It had been cut out especially for the executions and was so narrow that victims automatically leant back against the sandstone. Let me pause there. So it sounds like apparently somebody's been doing a whole bunch of work, a whole bunch of manual labor, cutting things, doing things, preparing things. And who's been doing the work? Have the German soldiers been digging all this time? Again, are there enough soldiers? Later on, when you dig into all aspects of the Holocaust, you'll learn to ask all kinds of questions about everything. Let's continue. Below them was a sea of bodies covered in blood. On the other side, the machine gun crews had built a fire where they brewed coffee. When the ledge was full, they left the fire and returned to their guns. Then they loosed off a burst along the line as each person was hit. They fell into the sea of bodies below. Around 34,000 people were killed that day. So keep that in mind. 34,000 people apparently rounded up by German troops. And were there even enough German troops to come and hound 34,000 people around? So let's continue. One woman escaped, though. Her name was Dina Mironova Pronichev. So that's the lady that I've mentioned. She was an actress and mother of two. Her husband was Russian. She did not look Jewish, spoke Ukrainian, and could have passed as one. When she read the notice, she decided not to go. However, she would see her parents to the train, then return home to look after the children. So this is her story, and this is a very important story. From here to the end, this is very important, so follow this closely. When she realized what was happening, her parents told her she should save herself. She approached one of the Ukrainian policemen and showed him her union card, which did not mention her ethnic group. He set her to one side with the Ukrainians who had got mixed in with the Jews. "We'll shoot the Jews first, then let you out," he said. But when a German officer turned up, he ordered that she should be shot anyway. They were the last batch that day. When she stood on the ledge, she heard the bullets coming towards her. Before they reached her, she jumped. It was a long drop, but she landed softly on the bodies below and was splattered with blood. Beneath her, she could feel people moving. The Germans climbed down and walked over the corpses, shooting anyone still alive. One SS man caught his foot on Dina. He shone a torch in her face, then picked her up and punched her, but she hung limp and lifeless. He kicked her in the chest and trod on her hand so the bones cracked. Then he walked away. Earth was piled on top of the bodies. Sand went in Dina's mouth, and she realized that she would rather be shot than buried alive. She held her breath to stop herself coughing and wriggling free. It had been a long day for the Ukrainian policemen, and they only covered the corpses with a light sprinkling of sand. In the dark, she crawled to the edge of the pit. She dug handholds in the sandy sides and hauled herself out. Hearing a whisper, she nearly jumped back into the pit. It was a young boy who had somehow escaped too. Together, they crawled off into the night. They made little progress. When it grew light, they hid in some bushes on the edge of another ravine. From there, they watched the Germans sorting out people's belongings. An old woman and her 6-year-old grandson came by. The Germans shot them. 6 or 7 Germans led 2 young women out onto a ledge on the other side of the ravine and gang-raped them. When they had finished, they bayoneted them, leaving their bodies there naked with their legs spread. All the time in the background was the sound of shooting. Dina fell into a trance, saw her mother, father and sister in long white robes. She was awoken by the boy who said plaintively, "Don't die, lady, don't leave me." When it grew dark again, they crawled on. Towards dawn, the boy crawled ahead as a lookout. She heard him shout, "Don't move, lady, there are Germans here." Then she heard them shoot him. Luckily, they had not understood what he had said, and they did not come looking for her. She was so distraught that she temporarily lost her mind, digging a small hole, then filling it up with sand, as if she was burying the boy who had saved her. The next day, she took refuge in a rubbish tip, covering herself with rags and boxes. Occasionally, she heard Germans passing by. Across the road, she saw tomatoes growing in a garden. So when it was dark, she crawled over and ate them. Still, she dragged herself on. At around dawn, she saw a barn behind a cottage and slipped inside, hearing a dog barking. A woman came out of the cottage and sent her son to fetch the Germans. They took Dina to a guardhouse where soldiers were drinking coffee. She went to sit on a chair, but they shouted at her and made her sit on the floor. When the soldiers went, they left one behind on duty. He was sympathetic and let Dina sit on the chair. Later, he gave her a rag and indicated that she should clean the window. He told her to look out of the window and pick out the way she had to run. But before she could escape, an officer turned up with 2 15-year-old girls. They were sobbing, kissing his boots, and telling him he could do anything he liked with them, including have sex with them, if he did not shoot them. The soldier took them and Dina back to the place where the victims had been stripped. Around 40 old men and women were sitting among the clothes. One was lying paralyzed. They were guarded by a single sentry. "Don't look at me," he shouted at Dina. "I can't do anything for you. I have children too." A girl in a soldier's tunic and greatcoat approached, putting the coat around Dina, who was shivering in the cold. She was a 19-year-old Russian nurse who had been left behind in the Soviet retreat. A lorry arrived and they climbed aboard. It took them to a garage that was being used as a temporary prison. When they arrived, an old woman got off and squatted down to relieve herself. In response, a German soldier shot her in the head. The garage was already full of people rounded up on the streets waiting to be shot, so the lorry pulled off again, seemingly heading for the Brest-Litovsk highway. It was going full tilt when Dina threw herself off. Either the guards did not see her or did not care, because the lorry did not stop. A group of people gathered around her. She explained that she had meant to go to the market, but had missed her stop and jumped off. They did not believe her, but took her to a nearby farmhouse anyway. Half an hour later, she found refuge with her brother's wife, who was Polish. Over the next 2 years, the slaughter continued. Between 100,000 and 200,000 Jews, communist officials, Russian prisoners of war were killed at Babi Yar. When the Germans retreated in August 1943, they had bodies exhumed by slave labor and burnt in huge pyres in an attempt to conceal what they had done. Dina survived the war and was the only eyewitness to what happened at Babi Yar on 29 September 1941. End of the chapter. Okay, so that was Dina's story, and I didn't want to interfere with Dina's story of this Jewish woman, the only survivor. But the critical part, the first critical point that I must point out to you in that chapter was, Dina survived the war and was the only eyewitness to what had happened at Babi Yar on 29 September 1941. She survived the war and was the only eyewitness to what happened on that day. So, we have one person's testimony of that day where apparently 34,000 Jews were killed on that day, but the main killing of the Jews would be on that day and the next day. So here is a woman who survived being shot at. And she tells her story. So let's take a closer look at her story, because there are a number of interesting aspects to her story. And notice, she's an actress. She's an actress. She knows about make-believe, and she knows about drama. So if we go to Wikipedia, and we look and see what is in Wikipedia right now in 2021, what is in Wikipedia right now? What does it say about Bobby Yar? It talks about survivors, and it says, one of the most often cited parts of Anatoly Kuznetsov's documentary novel, by the way, Bobby Yar, is the testimony of Dina Pronicheva, an actress of the Kiev Puppet Theatre and a survivor. And it continues, she was one of those ordered to march to the ravine, as you heard in the book, to be forced to undress and then be shot. Then it said, jumping before being shot and falling on other bodies, she played dead in a pile of corpses. So here in this area that I've underlined is this sentence, jumping before being shot and falling on other bodies. She jumped before she was shot. So there is what Wikipedia says. So that's obviously the normal narrative. But if we go into the book, the part that I was reading, you'll see all of that is in here, but there's more detail in here. And so here it says, we'll shoot the Jews first, then let you out, blah, 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 and ordered that they be shot anyway. They were the last batch that day. How convenient. But here is more detail in this book, and it says, when she stood on the ledge, she heard the bullets coming towards her. Before they reached her, she jumped. It was a long drop, but she landed softly on the bodies below and was splattered with blood. So she stood on the ledge and she heard the bullets coming towards her. And that was something that caught my attention. I have read lots of military literature, even spoken to soldiers, and I've never before heard of anybody talking about making a move before a bullet hits you. That you can actually hear the bullet coming, and you hear the bullet and you manage to dodge out of the way. Consider that in the days of muskets, for example, the musket balls were probably going slower than a World War II rifle. And remember I told you that you must remember the fact that it's a machine gun. It's a machine gun, right? So that machine gun is very possibly firing a lot faster rounds even than a normal rifle. And she can hear the bullets coming to her, and before they reach her, she jumps in. So she actually can hear the bullet and make a move and basically dodge the bullet, basically. Now, there are a number of issues here. The one is, why does she hear the bullets? From what I understand, they're standing on a ledge. If her science is correct, understand this. Suppose she's facing, so here's a question. Is she facing the machine gun or turning her back to the machine gun? I'm assuming from this story that she had to have had her back to the machine gun, that they weren't facing the machine gun. Because why is it necessary for her to hear the bullet? You see, what you've got here is you've got two issues here. The one is the speed of light, and the other one is the speed of sound. If she's standing in front of that machine gun, and that machine gun fires, she will see the casings. She will see the casings of the fired bullets. She'll see the shell casings falling out, and she'll see the machine gun actually firing the instant that it fires. The very instant. Light travels at 186,000 miles per second. But sound is much slower. Much slower. So why is she listening for the sound and not looking at the actual... If she was looking at someone shooting at her, she would see the motion of the weapon as it starts shooting, because it's making movements. You would immediately see when a soldier fires around, puts his finger on the trigger of the machine gun, he would immediately see the thing starting to recoil, and you'd see also the movement of the machine gun belt, the casings shooting out. You'd see it immediately within a split second. But the sound of that will take a while to reach you. So it sounds like they're sitting on the other side of the ravine, and the Germans are quite a way away on the other side of the ravine. So the ravine is here, and they're standing on a ledge on the other side of the ravine, and the Germans are on the opposite side, shooting at them from the opposite side. So there's a bit of a distance here. So that makes the whole story even more improbable. So if she had to hear the bullets, then the only logical thing for me is that she had to have been facing away from the machine gun. Okay? That's the only reason you'd want to hear the bullets. Because if you looked at it, you would see it firing straight away. And it is a bit of a problem trying to figure out the finer details of this thing. But let's say the Germans are behind her, and the Germans are now shooting at her. So she's relying on her sense of hearing. And honestly, the only reason she could rely on her sense of hearing has to be that she's not facing the machine gun. So then I assume she jumped backwards instead of forwards. If they had been behind her and she was facing the pit, and they were shooting her from behind, and she was facing the pit, and she jumped forward into the pit, that would make more sense. But it sounds almost like she's jumping backwards into the pit, which to me is a little bit more difficult. But anyway, the issue here is the bullets coming. She hears the bullets coming. Let me tell you something. If any soldier in any war could save his life by listening to the sound of bullets coming to him and then ducking and so on, let me tell you, you'd hear lots of stories of that. You'd hear lots of stories about that. But there's a problem here. There's a problem here. And the problem is that bullets move faster than the speed of sound. So let's take a look at muzzle velocities. The speed of sound, here on Wikipedia, speed of sound is 1,235 kilometers per hour. This translates into 1,125 feet per second. So 1,100 feet per second. That's the speed of sound. Now, if you take a look at a normal rifle like the British had, a British .303 rifle, the .303's muzzle velocity is 2,400 feet per second. So a normal .303 rifle, its ammunition travels more than twice the speed of sound. The Germans in World War II apparently were mostly armed with a Mauser, and actually they were mostly armed with bolt-action rifles, though they did have other fancier weapons later, but the standard armament of a German soldier was a Mauser carabiner, and its muzzle velocity is 2,493 feet per second, slightly faster than the .303. Now, she said that there was a machine gun. A very common machine gun in World War II was the MG-42. The MG-42 had an unbelievable rate of fire. Its muzzle velocity was 2,428 feet per second. So the bottom line is that these standard rifles had muzzle velocities more than twice the speed of sound. And therein lies your problem. There is no ways she could hear the bullet coming. In order to hear the bullet coming, sound has to reach your ears. Okay? The bullet is moving faster than the sound. The bullet will hit you before the sound reaches you. But there it is, that she heard the bullets coming towards her and she jumped before they reached her. Now, even if by some method of Jewish physics, even if it was possible for her to hear the bullet coming, the next question is the rate at which that bullet is moving. She'd better be reacting really fast. And if she has to jump and make any kind of motion, which in any way is slightly upwards or whatever, the question is, in that split second that she's jumping and then her body's got to accelerate downwards, how far will the bullet be traveling in that period of time as well? Let me tell you, there's no soldier on earth, no soldier, no policeman on earth who ever heard a bullet coming and avoided it. Nobody who was being shot at by snipers, nobody who was in warfare, nobody who's been in a gunfight has ever been able to save their lives by listening to the sound of the thing coming. The same is true for many other things. The things happen, and by the time that you hear it, by the time you hear the noise, you know that you're lucky enough to have survived, because by the time you hear the noise, the bullet has already gone long past you. I read a very fascinating book about snipers in World War I. Very fascinating book, quite a long time ago. And a sniper, this was a South African sniper, and he was in World War I, and he spoke about sniping, shooting Germans, Germans shooting at you, and talking about what happens when you hear the sound. You are sitting there with your sniper's rifle and you're shooting at a German far away. you see a German climb out of a trench and you take a shot at him. And he said, if you miss the German, then you know it, because he'll suddenly react when he hears the sound. So you'll fire and then you'll see the German ducking. But by the time the German's ducking, it's really too late. The bullet's already past him. So by looking at the guy's reaction, you can tell certain things. And he went into a lot of detail about sniping and the issues of sniping, and also when you're being shot at, etc. So there's nobody ever that survived on the basis of hearing bullets coming. It's not possible. The bullet is traveling faster than the speed of sound. It's that simple. But there it is. So to me, it appears that they had to be behind her when they shot at her. And the only thing that makes sense is that she jumped even backwards. And wouldn't it have been a bit strange if the Germans had a whole bunch of people lined up and the machine gun goes brrr, and the machine gunner sees, hold on, that person fell in long before the other people fell in. That's a bit weird. Hey, there's somebody we've got to go and shoot. It would really look strange if there's like 10 people lined up and they shoot them all and they see all of them dropping down, but they see one having fallen into the pit before the others, and it would be very noticeable. Honestly, the whole thing doesn't make sense. So was this woman ever shot at? No ways in hell. There's no ways in hell this woman knows what it's like to be shot at. There's no ways that she could have. On the same page, another thing that's also very dodgy is this part where it says, one SS man caught his foot on Dina. He shone a torch in her face, then picked her up and punched her, but she hung limp and lifeless. He kicked her in the chest and trod on her hand so her bones cracked. That stuff, that can also not be real. That also cannot be real. I must tell you, that cannot be real, because you see, if you've ever shot anything, if you've ever shot an animal or something, and you've seen what an animal is like when it's lifeless, okay? Let me tell you, if a guy came and picked you up and kicked you and beat you, and you're not actually dead, you will make some kind of noise. There will be some kind of reaction. You cannot fake being limp and lifeless if someone picks you up. You cannot fake this stuff. To be limp and lifeless, I don't think you can do that. You have to see how limp and lifeless something is that is actually dead. No ways could somebody come and kick you in the chest and even picking up somebody who's limp. You know, there are many problems with this, I want to tell you. So that also is not so. Then the rest of her story about how she and the boy escapes, and then the boy gets shot, but the Germans don't find her, and then she's caught and she's back there by the Germans, and the German troops catch her again, and then eventually she jumps out of the truck, jumps out of a moving truck. Lots and lots and lots of stuff in there that I truly doubt. I truly doubt that. Very, very laborious story. And when I look at that whole story of all the things that happened to her afterwards, there are just so many tales that she tells. And when I look at it, I think it's for theatrical purposes. She needs to embellish her story. she needs to embellish her story. So she goes on with these other things. Oh, and then I ran into these Germans, and then they had these girls, and then this happened and that happened. All theatrically embellished. A whole bunch of stories theatrically embellished. One improbable thing on top of another. And then getting more chances to say some nasty things about the Germans. Oh, see, there was this old woman, and then they just shot her. And, you know, the need to embellish and carry on and build the story up into something bigger than it was. If she truly escaped, then, you know, why would she be caught again and then moved here and then this happens and that happens? No, man. This whole thing is a made-up story. But the thing that drew my attention originally was when it said she heard the bullets coming towards her. Then I spoke to a friend of mine who's a hunter. I said to him, does this sound right? She heard the bullets coming. And my hunter friend, who's a Boer, he said to me, you'll feel the bullet before you hear the bullet. You'll feel it. And if you've ever shot any kind of animal or anything, you'll know that it's no joke. The bullet is straight through your body in an instant, man. There's no time for any of this other stuff. The white man's science and technology works incredibly fast. You cannot outrun a bullet. You cannot duck and dive from a bullet. You can't do these things. Your physical reactions aren't fast enough, man. You can go and look at any kind of shooting and hunting. There's lots of hunting videos online. Go and look at hunting videos where the guys are shooting, where these American guys are shooting at a whole bunch of coyotes or boars or other wildlife at night. So you've got a whole bunch of animals and they're busy doing their thing quietly, and the guy's sitting there with his scope at night and he fires a shot. And you'll see he fires a shot and the animal just drops dead instantly. And only then do all the other animals hear the sound, and then you see them running. But the animals, until that bullet hits them, the animal doesn't notice a thing. In fact, those animals just flop over. Most of them just flop over, and they didn't know what hit them. They are totally buggered. So, you know, this notion that, you know, you can hear bullets, get out of the way of bullets, nah, can't be done. Big story, load of nonsense. Lots and lots of soldiers have been in trenches. They stick their heads out of the trenches, etc. See if you can find a single example of a soldier in a trench where he sticks his head out of the trench and he hears bullets coming and then he ducks down. No. In fact, I'll tell you a story from an uncle of mine. I only had one uncle who was dumb enough to actually fight in World War II. My family did not take part in World War II at all. My family were not interested in it at all. And I only had one uncle here in South Africa. His name was Uncle Reg. And Reg volunteered. He was a miner. And he volunteered to fight in World War II. And he and a whole bunch of his buddies volunteered to go and fight in World War II. And he even said that they were promised farms. So they were promised farms. And that's the real reason he went to fight in World War II. He wanted a farm. It wasn't because of anything else. He was looking for a farm. And of course, it's just more recruitment bullshit from the Allied side and the South African side at the time, just talking all kinds of shit to the men. Yeah, come, we'll give you this, we'll give you that. Just come join the army and fight the Germans. Anyway, so Uncle Reg ended up in the South African army in the desert and later even in Italy, and there were a couple of stories he told. But one particular story I want to tell you about my Uncle Reg is the following. Uncle Reg at a point was in North Africa, and they were fighting against Rommel, and they were in trenches. And so he and a buddy of his, he was quite a wild guy, this Uncle Reg. He and a buddy of his, they decided to do some, play a little game to see how close the bullets would come to them. So they had like a bucket, and they'd stick their heads up out of the trench or close to the top of the trench, and then they'd put this like bucket on their heads, and then every now and then they'd take the bucket off their heads and they'd see, you know, how close did a bullet come to their heads. And these two played this perverse game, and you know, to see who came closest to being killed but wasn't killed. Anyway, they were playing their little game one day, and after a while, Uncle Reg noticed that he hadn't heard from his buddy for a while, and he turned around, and his buddy's head had been totally shot off by the Germans. So that was like a nasty little reminder for him. So again, you know, you can't duck and dive. You can't duck and dive. When the bullet or the shell comes, it'll rip your head or your arm or your leg off, and there's no way around it. You know, you're not going to hear it coming. You're not even if somehow you could see, even if she could have seen the machine gun fire, even if she could have seen the machine gun fire and she jumped at the time that she saw it fire, even then I doubt she could have gotten away. But of course, there's just no ways in hell if she was relying on hearing. No ways in hell. And so that's that story. When I looked at that, I was like, nah, this woman has never been shot at. She's never been shot at. She knows nothing about being shot at. And even that story of later she jumps off of a truck. You jump off a moving vehicle going at a speed, and you're going to be hurt, man. It's not something that just everybody does. Now, this woman's full of tall tales, I must tell you, when I look at her story. So, yeah, when I saw this piece, she heard the bullets coming towards her. That was the beginning of me saying, hold on. How much of this story is actually real? And here you have it. So this is a different Holocaust story. This is the one of being shot at. And I can tell you, I'm quite certain this woman was never shot at in her life. She doesn't know what it's like. And her descriptions of these things, and all this unnecessary stuff. Oh, the SS man came and picked her up and punched her, but she hung limp and lifeless. You don't know what limp and lifeless is. You don't know what limp and lifeless is. If you've gone and shot some animals, you'll know what limp and lifeless is. And let me tell you, you cannot act limp and lifeless. You cannot act like that. You can try what you want. And if you want to act limp and lifeless, then you just lie on the ground and you lie still. But here she's saying, oh, he picked her up and he punched her and kicked her and you know, she was able to fake, you know, able to fool him. No. If he came and kicked you, you would make some kind of noise. There'd be some involuntary movement, I can tell you. If he kicked you and punched you, there'd be some involuntary movement. He would know, as an experienced soldier, he would know in short order, this person ain't dead. And he wouldn't even have to come and kick and punch you. If he was walking around looking for people who might be still alive, he could just come and put a bullet in you. And she's got this whole thing about the Germans shooting people, and then the Germans going and walking around because there were still some people moving and blah, blah, blah. I don't know. If you've really shot any kind of animal, you will very quickly be able to tell, is that animal still alive? and you won't even have to come close to them in order to see it. Go and look at hunting videos. Go and look at hunting videos and look at animals when they're shot dead instantly, and look at animals when they're wounded. You will see in a second. You don't have to even go to the animal in order to figure out, is it dead? You will, most of the time, 99% of the time, you'll be able to figure it out just visually. It's not difficult. And all this other stuff, lots of theatrics, I must tell you. Lots of theatrics in here. And, yeah. So, Jewish physics doesn't always work, eh? I just want to clarify this particular photo that I used, that I found on the internet. This photo shows men being shot, and they're being shot into a pit, and this apparently is in Serbia. These are very likely partisans or other types of resistance people, and you must remember that killing people who were fighting behind enemy lines, that is a normal part of the rules of warfare. That happens to anybody. So these definitely look like men who are being punished for some kind of resistance. Basically terrorism. It's basically terrorism behind the enemy lines, because that is what happens. And this looks like a standard firing squad kind of execution. Got about five guys aiming at one guy. So, yeah. Remember, the Americans did the same thing to Germans. So this is all part and parcel of warfare. And while I was looking for photographs, I came upon this photo, which is from an NBC story. This is about another guy who's been grabbed due to his role in killings. And what's interesting is that this photo is said to be from Babi Yar. So this is a screenshot that I took from the NBC website. So it says, the Nazis established death camps partially due to concerns about the psychological effects up-close mass killings were having on the Einsatzgruppen troops. I'm not so sure, but anyway. But here's the interesting part, is that this photo apparently is from Babi Yar. And so it says the following. It says, this photo taken from the body of a dead German officer who was killed in Russia shows a German firing squad shooting Soviet civilians in the back as they sit beside a mass grave in the Babi Yar ravine on the outskirts of Kiev. The thing that is strange for me about this photo is the headgear of the troops. I cannot see that German helmet that you normally can see. The headgear of the troops is rather strange to me. And the other thing is that I think this actually is different to the claims by Dina. When I look at this photograph, this photograph says these are Germans killing Soviet civilians at Babi Yar outside Kiev. Now, according to Wikipedia and others, the Germans apparently killed the non-Jews at other times. But the location is supposed to be the same. You would expect the layout of the setup to be similar, if not identical. But it's not. People are sitting on the edges of what appears to be a trench. Now, if we go back to this book, to page 130, where it describes the place where Dina was apparently shot, it's very different. It's quite confusing to understand, to be honest with you. Because in this photo, again, like in the other photo, the people are facing with their backs to those who are firing at them. But listen to this. It says, the lines of naked people, and by the way, in the photos that you see here, the two photos I've shown you, the one of Serbia and the one here, the people are not naked, hey? Notice the people are being shot with their clothes on. So that's also a difference with the storyline, that the people are naked when they're being shot. No, they're being shot with their clothes on. Look, they've even got caps and jackets on. But again, what I find very strange about this photo is the uniform, especially the headgear. That doesn't look like Germans, hey? I wonder where that really comes from. But anyway, let's just carry on. Let's just go back to the book, page 130. It says, the lines of naked people were marched through into the ravine and lined up on a narrow ledge in the quarry. So now it's like there's no digging that's been done. It's like this is a quarry. Then it says, it had been cut especially for the executions and was so narrow that the victims automatically leant back against the sandstone. So they're on a ledge and they lean backwards onto the sandstone. So it sounds like they are facing forwards into the place they're going to fall. It says, below them was a sea of bodies covered in blood. On the other side, see, it's like there's a ditch, a hole, a trench, or a big ditch that you're going to fall into. Then it says, on the other side, the machine gun crews had built a fire where they brewed coffee. When the ledge was full, they left the fire and returned to their guns. Then they loosed off a burst along the line. As each person was hit, they fell into the sea of bodies below. Around 34,000 people were killed that day. So in that case, it sounds like they are looking at the machine gun. And it says a sea of bodies. So it sounds like a big wide thing that's there. But maybe in order for this to make sense, Dina then had to lean against the sandstone with her face. But here in the book it says they leant back against the sandstone. So, you know, the question is, which way was she facing? That's the real issue. And these people here in this photo that they say is from Babi Yar, this does not match in any way, shape or form the description of Dina of what happened there. Because it seems that in all cases, whether it's these Soviet citizens or the Jews, they were shot at the same place. But this photograph does not match the description. So for me, even from this, it's still up in the air. Was she facing the weapon or wasn't she facing the weapon? Was she, the only thing that makes sense for her to have heard the bullet is that she has to be facing away from it. But by this description, the people are leaning with their backs against the sandstone. So was she leaning with her face against the sandstone? God knows. You know, when I look at this, there are things that just don't match up. And this photo that was used, and this has to do with the trial, this photo does not in any way match Dina's description of Barbie Yacht. And here there's no machine gun, there are guys with rifles. And I must tell you, when I look at this photo, to me, there are a number of things about this photo that make me think that this photo is not even a World War II photo. I wonder if this isn't a photo from World War I or from the Bolshevik Revolution, because the grain of the photo, the headdress of this, I don't see that this is even Soviet civilians being shot by Germans. No ways. You can see the one in Serbia, that in that photo, what you've got are guys in German uniforms and they're shooting men. But here you're seeing civilians being shot. So I'm not going to go into a study of all the photos that I've looked at. I'm just going to leave it at this, because this photo is a recent photo that was used in Germany, and it was claimed that this photo is from Barbie Yacht. It was used to prosecute somebody who was apparently there involved in this. But this photo, to me, is very dodgy. This photo of these civilians being killed, I don't think that this is the German army. I don't think so. This photo, to me, has a kind of a World War I Russian Revolution, Bolshevik Revolution kind of look to it. But this they claim, is from Germans shooting Soviet civilians at Barbie Yacht. But it doesn't match the description of Dina. And even Dina's description of the place where she was apparently shot, even that doesn't make quite sense. So, yeah, just more weirdness, eh? More weird, creepy stuff regarding the evidence of Barbie Yacht. So let's take a look at what Wikipedia says about Barbie Yacht, because there are some things in here that you'll see will confirm what I've been telling you about what was in this book. So it says here, location was Kiev, date was 29th to 30 September 1941. In other words, 2 days. This is the key point. This thing happened. The initial story is the story of this Jewish woman, and it's for 2 days only. So it says incident type is genocide, mass murder, perpetrators, blah, 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 these Germans, and apparently all these Germans. And it's at this concentration camp. Then it says, victims, 33,771 Jews in an initial 2-day massacre. Then it says, 29 survived. And then it goes on to say, 100,000 to 150,000 Jews, Soviet prisoners of war, Romanis, those are gypsies, etc., etc. But it starts, the key event is this initial 2-day Jewish massacre. So then under survivors, it says the following. One of the most often cited parts of Anatoly Kuznetsov's documentary novel, Barbie Yacht, is the testimony of Dina Pronicheva. Now listen to this. It says, an actress, and a survivor. So this lady is an actress. She can play a role, hey? So how much of her acting skills came into this apparent story? And it says, she was one of those ordered to march to the ravine, to be forced to undress and then be shot. So this is sitting in Wikipedia. Look here. It says the same thing as in the book. It says jumping before being shot and falling on other bodies. She played dead in a pile of corpses. But there you have it. There's the key element there. Jumping before being shot. It doesn't have the section about hearing the bullet coming and jumping and being able to avoid the bullet. But basically boils down to the same thing. Only thing it doesn't say is that she heard the bullet coming. So there you've got the very basis. This is the very basis for her as a survivor. And then it says, she held perfectly still while the Nazis continued to shoot the wounded or gasping victims. Although the SS had covered the mass grave with earth, she eventually managed to climb through the soil and escape. So, how she managed to breathe with soil on her, I don't know. Since it was dark, she had to avoid the torches of the Nazis, finishing off the remaining victims still alive, wounded, and gasping in the grave. She was one of the very few survivors of the massacre and later related her story to Kuznetsov. At least 29 survivors are known. But she was the original. Now, whether the others came along later and they came to the fore and then they also said, yes, I was also there. But she was the key player in creating the story. And then we get to this part, this good old part here, concealment of the crimes. Now, why are the crimes concealed? Well, you'll see why. It says, before the Nazis retreated from Kiev, ahead of the Soviet offensive of 1944, they were ordered by Wilhelm Koppe to conceal their atrocities in the East. Paul Blobel, who had been in control of the mass murders in Babi Yar 2 years earlier, supervised the Sonderaktion 1005 in eliminating its traces. Aktion was carried out earlier in all extermination camps. The bodies were exhumed, burned, and the ashes scattered over farmland in the vicinity. Several hundred prisoners of war from the Syretz concentration camp were forced to build funeral pyres out of Jewish gravestones and exhume the bodies for cremation. So now there's this long story about how all these people came and hid the crime. They actually dig into the ground, they pull out the bodies, then they cremate them. So you've got soil-covered bodies that you're now trying to burn. I would imagine that would be harder than burning them when they are, let's call it clean. But this apparently is what happened. Then you'll see more. It says numbers murdered. Estimates of the total number killed at Babi Yar during the Nazi occupation vary. Well, of course it varies because it's based on junk. It's based on junk facts, actually. And it's the same. You'll find the same thing with all the different places where the Jews apparently were killed. There's no science involved. There's no physical evidence. So then these numbers start coming up. So it says, in 1946, Soviet prosecutor Ellen Simov at the Nuremberg trials claimed there were approximately 100,000 corpses lying in Babi Yar. Using materials of the Extraordinary State Commission set out by the Soviets to investigate Nazi crimes after the liberation of Kiev in 1943. According to testimonies of workers forced to burn the bodies, The numbers range from 70,000 to 120,000. In a recently published letter to Israeli journalist, writer and translator Shlomo Evan Shoshan, so probably another Jew, dated 17 May 1965, Anatoly Kuznetsov commented on the Barbie Yard atrocity. In the 2 years that followed, Ukrainians, Russians, Gypsies, and people of all nationalities were murdered in Barbie Yard. The belief that Barbie Yard is an exclusively Jewish grave is wrong. It is an international grave. Then he says, nobody will ever determine how many and what nationalities are buried there, because 90% of the corpses were burned, their ashes scattered in ravines and fields. For his war crimes, Paul Blobel was sentenced to death by the subsequent Nuremberg trials. In the Einsatzgruppen trial, he was hanged on 7 June 1951 at Landsberg prison. So the bottom line is that now after the event, you now find that apparently you can't get any real physical evidence, because apparently not only did the Nazis kill them, but then the Nazis came back later, dug them up, and then cremated them. So the Nazis destroyed the evidence, so they claim. I must tell you, I find it all very problematic, because by 1944, the Germans were having real problems with the invasions in Italy, D-Day, etc. They were under lots of pressure on all fronts. I personally find it almost impossible to believe that the Germans would have wasted any resources on something as difficult as going and digging up the bodies. And again, what if the Germans dug up the bodies but left some? Why can't you go and look there now? If remains are scattered in ravines and fields, you want to tell me that scientists can't detect some of that? You're talking about 100,000 dead people. You want to tell me that if you truly were interested in forensic science, that you couldn't find some kind of evidence? I must tell you, I find it really hard to believe. But the stories are such that, well, the Germans killed them, and then the Germans got rid of the evidence. That's why there's no evidence. Really? Is that so? I just want to read an article that was originally published on the website Christians for Truth. And the article is called 1943, Jewish Press Publishes Cover Story to Explain Why No Mass Graves of Jews Would Be Found After the War. In other words, the Jews know that they're lying, and they're already preparing the way for the future, so that when people look for evidence after the war, there won't be evidence. So this is what the article says. Despite all the allegations for the last 75 years of 6 million Jews murdered by the Germans during World War II, there were no mass graves ever found after the war with scientifically documented remains of Jews. During the war, the Jews clearly anticipated this problem, which would undermine their pre-planned Holocaust narrative. So they planted stories in newspapers which they largely controlled, with stories explaining why no such mass graves with Jews in them would be found after the war ended. In 1943, the Jewish Telegraphic Agency, a major Zionist newspaper, published one such cover story. and it reads, "Fearing the retribution which the United Nations announced they would deal out to them for their atrocities against civilians, the Nazis in Poland are endeavoring to remove all traces of their crimes against Poles and Jews, according to a report in the Dziennik Polski, official organ of the Polish government in exile, published in London. The Nazis, the paper charges, are exhuming the bodies of Jews and Poles murdered at Lublin, Warsaw, and Treblinka, and cremating the corpses. It is the intent of the Nazis, when called to account for the crimes, to demand of the United Nations the evidence of such crimes. This, they believe, the Allies will not be in a position to offer if the bodies are cremated." So that's an interesting story published in 1943, right in the middle of the war, already talking about the notion that there won't be any evidence after the war. So the article continues, "After the war, at the Nuremberg kangaroo show trials, a small number of Jewish, quotes, eyewitnesses, who were never allowed to be cross-examined by the defense, made astonishingly exaggerated claims about gassings and mass murder at three camps in Poland, Sobibor, Belzec, and Treblinka." But as you've seen, we've now been looking at an eyewitness from Babi Yar. And so the same stuff surely applies also to Babi Yar, that we've had a Jewish eyewitness, and if the others were not allowed to be cross-examined, then this woman probably was not cross-examined either. So it continues, "Jewish groups claimed that 2 million Jews were liquidated at these three camps alone, literally the population of Chicago, without a trace. These numbers are so absurd. There are many prominent Jews now who are openly questioning the Holocaust dogma. A major problem for these Jewish exterminationist conspiracy theorists was that there was no room in these tiny camps to bury 2 million people. So they came up with an elaborate explanation why no mass graves were ever found, and why even ground-penetrating radar studies showed no evidence of mass burial of any cremated remains." Let me just pause there. There were people who took ground-penetrating radar to various places, I know especially at Treblinka, and they used it to go over the soil to see if they could find any evidence of disturbances, of digging, and anything of remains under the soil. And they found nothing. They found that the ground had never been disturbed. And later also, people asked the chief rabbi of Poland whether they could start digging there so that they can dig out these dead Jews and start studying them. And then the chief rabbi said, no, it's better to just leave them be. And then the Jews came along and they chucked concrete and rocks all over the place. They put concrete and rocks over the whole area so that now nobody can go and dig in the ground where they claim that there are dead Jews there, that the remains of dead Jews are to be found there. And again, you know, the spaces and areas are small, and these camps are actually not that impressive. So when you have these numbers, 2 million people here, 1 million people over there, it's really not going to be difficult. Even if there was cremation, it's really not going to be difficult to dig in the soil using scientific techniques and to actually find evidence, any evidence. You'll find something, man. If you have 2 million dead people there in these small areas, you're gonna find proof. Proof of the digging, proof of the ash and the bones. You'll find something. You cannot just wish it away. Science is much more precise than that. But somehow, for these mysterious dead Jews, you can't find any proof that they existed. So it continues. According to this Jewish conspiracy theory, the Nazis forced the inmates to dig up 2 million corpses. Let me just pause there. To dig up 2 million people. Remember, now these people are in the ground. And have you dug in all the places? Have you found every last one of those corpses? It's very unlikely. Even if you did do it, chances are you'd have missed some. There's no question about it. But anyway, to dig up 2 million people, to dig up the remains of 2 million bodies a year or 2 years after they've been killed, so they've been partly decomposed. It's, you're not even going to pick up a whole body. You're going to have parts of things here and there. Now you've got to pick these pieces up and go, these dirt-covered pieces, and now you're going to go and burn it. No, man. This is just rubbish. But anyway, it says, the Nazis forced the inmates to dig up 2 million corpses that had previously been gassed and buried, and then those 2 million corpses were cremated on open-air barbecue pyres. Let me stop there. That also is a problem, because proper cremation, you need proper machines to do cremation. To just burn people on pyres isn't actually anywhere close to being as efficient as actually putting them in a crematorium, in a proper machine built for that. And even a proper machine that's built for that battles to burn all that flesh and bone away, and the bone always remains even in the most modern, advanced crematoriums. So all of this, when you scrutinize this closely, this is all rubbish, okay? Then it continues. The cremated ash and bones were then allegedly pulverized by hand into dust and then reburied. So first you go dig them out, then you do this bad cremation exercise, and then you still got to go and take all the bones and pulverize it by hand into dust. Then you still got to go and bury everything and cover everything. The whole thing is so insane. The amount of people you'd need, the resources you'd need for this, the Germans were busy with much more important stuff. They would never even have considered any of this. It continues, after the war, a massive cement memorial was conveniently built over the spot where the Germans allegedly ordered the Jewish inmates to bury the ash of 2 million fellow Jews, so that the evidence could never be disturbed and exhumed for verification. And that was originally written on Christians for Truth. But I totally agree with this. I looked at lots of Holocaust stuff years ago, and I want to tell you that when you get into it in detail, then you will be blown away. You'll be blown away by the improbability of all of this. There are people who've done all kinds of tests, all kinds of things from every conceivable angle. And I want to tell you that if you go and you examine their story closely, the entire story falls apart at the seams. The physics does not match up. It does not support the wild, wild claim. The man that you see on the screen there, that is General Heinz Guderian. And he was basically the father of tanks in Germany. And there's a quote from him, "There are no desperate situations, there are only desperate people." Anyway, the reason that I've got Heinz Guderian there for you is because I sat and thought to myself when I did this video, I thought to myself, which German units got into Kiev at that time that there is this Jewish claim of this lot of killings in Kiev? And I discovered that Heinz Guderian was one of the generals that Hitler had told that he must head towards Kiev. It was Hitler who decided that Kiev needed to be taken. And he reached this decision, which was totally different to what his officers said at the time. And I'm not going to go into all of that, but in a nutshell, I think Hitler was right, because Kiev was a highly industrial city, and it was very important to capture Kiev. Anyway, Guderian was one of those who was very much against this, but Guderian was ordered with his panzers that he needs to make a very important move in this battle for Kiev. And the battle for Kiev is an enormous battle. It's over a very wide area. It's not just Kiev, it's an enormous battle. So I thought, let me take a bit of a look at various books of mine just to see what they say. The upshot of it is that I can't figure out which units actually got into Kiev. But I can tell you a few things about what the Germans were up to, which will give an insight into what was really going on a broader scale. So in a book about panzer battles, it says here, the Kiev encirclement was over by 21 September, and, great victory or not, it had delayed the battle for Moscow by 2 months. On Wikipedia, it says, Kiev had effectively fallen by September 19th, but the encircled troops, that is the Russians, continued to put up a fight. The Red Army's 5th, 26th, 21st, 38th, and 37th Army were captured inside the circle. They fought for about 10 more days, but everything was falling apart. In Guderian's own biography, he writes, he says, on this day Kiev fell. Then he says, September 20th was a day of limited successes against the enemy to the east, but fighting went on against the encircled Russians, both in the sector of 3rd Panzer Division, which found itself opposed by the staff of the Russian 5th Army, and further to the south in the sector of the 25th Motorized Infantry Division, where part of the enemy's forces seemed to have broken out. Since the 13th of September, we had taken 30,000 prisoners. He continues, on the 20th, I visited, I don't know the number of this Panzer Corps because it's in it's in Roman numerals, okay, and I'm too lazy to go and figure out which one it is. And then he says, General von Weitinghoff described the difficulties his corps had while fighting their way southwards from Gluchov during the past few days. The students from the Russian war school at Kharkov had put up a particularly brave fight under the command of their instructors. Minefields and bad weather had held up the advance. Heavy battles were still going on in the neighborhood of Putovel, Shilovka, Bilopoli, and talks about, I went to find the infantry regiment Gross Deutschland, which was doing well under the command of Colonel Horlein to the east of Shilovka. Bilopoli was taken. Then he says, on September 21st, enemy pressure in the Gluchov area increased. Russian concentrations were reported to the north of that town. We launched an attack through Negrigalov. Panzer Group 1 reported 43,000 prisoners and 6th Army 63,000 captured since the beginning of the Battle of Kiev. On September 22nd, I once again drove to the front through Putovol towards Rylsk in order to inspect the defensive measures that were being taken in this threatened sector. So the bottom line is that in this time when this Jewish woman is busy claiming that the Germans are busy beating them with sticks and busy shooting them up, the reality of the matter is that the German army is extremely busy and they've got a lot of Russians still surrounded and there's a lot of fighting going on. So I'm not so sure that I take her descriptions of Germans loafing around and sitting around and Germans wanting to have sex with girls and sitting in various places and sort of playing around and loafing around. I don't find that very believable. I'm not saying that it's impossible, but I don't find it believable. And in fact, all these German units and generals, they all had lots of work to do. And the moment things were achieved, they were given other orders to go and do other things, move in other directions, etc. Everybody was very busy, and I don't think that the Germans had time to loaf around and play games. They had real things to do, and if they went into Kiev, they were also busy cleaning out the place, setting up defenses, checking for the enemy. There's clearly a lot of fighting and a lot of activity going on a vast scale. So anyway, I just don't find these stories that believable. Did the Germans in Kiev want to take the Jews and load them on trains and send them off somewhere else? That is very possible. In fact, a lot of what is called the Holocaust is actually nothing more than Jews being put on trains and sent off to labor camps where they are put to work. And Treblinka is a perfect example. Treblinka is nothing more than a railway station, and Jews were just passing through Treblinka on their way to other places. And the Germans were moving Jews to the east. They kept moving them eastwards, away from Europe. So the description of Germans grabbing 30,000 Jews and sort of marching them and herding them to a place where they're going to be killed, it's going to take quite a lot of soldiers to go and move 30,000 Jews and to, you know, herd them together the way she describes it. And I doubt that there were troops around who were in those numbers and who could go and play those games, because you'd still need at least a couple of hundred, if not a few thousand soldiers to do this. And I very much doubt that the German army would allocate several thousand troops to go and beat Jews with sticks at a point like this. I find it hard to believe. For me, my personal conclusion about this, my personal opinion about this, is that what you're looking at here is a Holocaust that was invented by one Jewish woman at some point, and it was used very handily at the Nuremberg trials. And just as those other articles said, you have an eyewitness that's not even properly cross-examined, that's just allowed to tell a story. It also seems that the main portion of the story actually comes from a novel, and then later on the story then gets a life of its own. It's then treated as real history, as actual incidents, etc., etc. But the really shocking thing, the really, really shocking thing, is that something that was just invented by somebody that's not true, that such a thing should go on and be reinforced by other Jews and others, maybe the British as well, maybe all part of this black propaganda stuff, that such a thing should eventually result in like a real memorial and real serious stuff at a place where maybe nothing like this ever happened. And that for me is quite a shocking thing, that you have a memorial to an event that never took place. Just sit and think about that. And that is agreed upon and regarded by history as a real event. But it ultimately has only got this one root, and that root is the story told by this one woman. So just sit and ponder the scale of that. That becomes a big deception, an enormous deception, a perversion of history. And imagine every year there's probably ceremonies there, and people come and they lay down wreaths and they cry over the dead, but maybe the original thing was absolutely nothing like this at all. You know, maybe the Germans captured some partisans and some Jews and shot them for doing a few things, for doing those bombings, and the Germans moved on, and the Germans didn't even notice anything. And a lot of this stuff, the Germans are busy with real things on an enormous scale. And this is in 1941 in Operation Barbarossa. The German army has got so much work to do, and they are rushing around all over Russia, dashing in different directions, fighting in different places on a vast, vast scale against an enormous army that had been prepared to invade Germany, which, by the way, they don't tell you about. That's a separate topic, is that Hitler's invasion, Operation Barbarossa, was actually a preemptive strike. The Soviet Union had a bit waiting to invade Germany, and Hitler smacked them straight in the kisser 2 weeks before they were going to invade German territory. That is the real story of Barbarossa. And so these Germans outwitted the Russians, smacked a huge Russian army, tore it to shreds in a couple of months. And these guys are busy with the greatest battles and the most intensive fighting in the history of the world. I'm not joking with you. These months when these things are happening, the greatest battles in the history of warfare are taking place in the Soviet Union. I find it impossible to believe that those German soldiers and officers were busy playing games, because, to be frank with you, the kind of stuff they were doing and the scale that they were doing it on was enormous, and it was very, very dangerous stuff that they were doing. And for them to now start and want to sit and play games, which is what basically this description is, for them to muck around and waste time and so forth. Some of these units are very tired as well. There is one particular unit, I forget which army it was, but after fighting in Kiev, they had to fight to the south, I think it was. And they did so for months on end, and eventually they lost a battle fatigue. The men were absolutely wiped out. These guys were giving it their everything. This was dangerous, dangerous, nasty stuff. And those soldiers were facing real enemies on a vast scale. I find all this other stuff to be really just a load of nonsense, to be honest with you. In the midst of real warfare, now you got somebody coming after the event and telling all kinds of fairy tales and stuff. That's my personal view, to be frank with you. But yeah, so a bunch of stuff for you to sit and think about, to think about this very strange story and what are the conclusions that one can draw from it. I have so many videos that I still want to do, and I've got an uncompleted video to do with Operation Barbarossa, and I will go and have a look at it to see if I can piece it together. Believe it or not, I actually did it in 2018. It's the longest running video that I've kind of left to one side in it about Operation Barbarossa and about the war and about why the Germans lost the war. And the bottom line is that Jewish Bolshevism, because let me just tell you, in those days the Germans didn't have the word communism. They didn't use the term communism. They spoke about Jewish Bolshevism. And Jewish Bolshevism was busy destroying it. Germany was basically destroying communism. Destroying communism. And along came America and Britain, and they saved Jewish Bolshevism. They saved it from total annihilation. If it wasn't for the enormous output of American factories and the Americans and British shipping weaponry to the Soviet Union on a scale that will shock you. It will shock you when you see the real numbers, because I put this in that original video. When you see the scale of help that the Soviets got, it is no wonder that the Germans eventually lost, because the Germans were effective occupiers at the same time in the Eastern Front. The scale of assistance from America was just shocking beyond belief. So you actually later can't even fault these generals for eventually losing, because the situation that they faced was literally impossible. But here in 1941, they were winning in the face of the impossible. They were actually destroying an army that the Soviets never imagined could be destroyed. The Germans tore it up. They tore it to pieces. They ripped an enormous Soviet army to pieces. And you hardly hear about it in the history books. They ignore and try to bypass these unbelievable victories that were taking place in 1941. In 1941, the Wehrmacht was the greatest European army that had ever existed in the history of the world. They were fighting the greatest battles that have ever been fought in the history of the world, and they were winning them like crazy. The greatest victories, the greatest battles, battles fought on a scale that had never been done before. And the Germans were ripping the enemy to shreds. They were tearing them apart. The Germans were killing more than 10 times the number of enemy they were losing in battle. It was incredible stuff. So yeah, lots of stuff to sit and think about, and also to think about all the junk spoken about the Germans. So here we are back at that page where President George Bush is busy speaking at the Babi Yar Holocaust Memorial in Kiev. And so the question in my mind is this: this entire monument, all this seriousness around this whole affair, it originally comes from that Dina woman. And is all of this just fake? One thing I do find interesting about her account, and I wonder about it, is even if the Germans burnt the bodies, which itself is an enormous tall tale that I find impossible to believe. Oh, they went and they dug out all the bodies. The other thing that she mentions is all the blood dripping, all the blood dripping, and all that kind of stuff. So you've shot 34,000 Jews, and there's all this bleeding and blood that's dripping into the soil. And of course, keep in mind that you've got other body fluids as well that can also be coming out. So you've got liquids that would be moving down into the soil. So even if you come back later and you dig up the bodies, I have a question. What about all that blood? There must be many liters and liters and maybe hundreds of liters of blood that has soaked into the soil. Could you detect that later? That is a question I have. I must tell you, I find the whole thing ridiculous. I don't believe this ever took place. And the fact that later, much later, suddenly then they found, there's another survivor. That in and of itself, there are so many Jewish survivors now after the events. And, you know, where were they? You know, why do you only discover these survivors now, decades later? I'm telling you, the whole thing to me, dodgy stuff. So, her stuff is the basis of everything that follows. But her stuff is dodgy. So, is it a case that an entire Holocaust was invented by one Jewish woman? That one Jewish woman, telling her tall tales, invented an entire Holocaust, and that Jews later move in and they embellish on this thing and they build on it. And it gains credibility, and now there's more survivors, and there are more academics, and the academics are telling you, no, well, you see, you won't be able to find physical evidence because it was all disposed of. You know, those nasty, nasty, sneaky Germans, they disposed of all of that. So it's the real lesson of this, that one woman tells a bold, bold lie. And other Jews come along and they add to the lie and they give logical support to the lie, and the lie becomes real and the lie becomes accepted, until governments are building monuments and presidents are flying there to tell their stories. But it's all a lie. It never happened. None of those things happened. So sit back and think about that, and think about the consequences of that. Isn't that scary? Isn't that scary that one is looking at things that may never have happened, but it's written in history, and there are apparently names of people there, and, you know, how solid is this history? How solid is this history? And to me, it doesn't look solid at all. To me, it's like this whole thing was started by her, and then her talking at Nuremberg. And how did that all come about, right? That she pitches up at Nuremberg and she gives a storyline, and now, decades later, it's real. There was no physical evidence, but it's real. It really did happen. Ask any magistrate, what is the most reliable form of evidence in a court? And magistrates will tell you, a magistrate or a judge will tell you, detective, anybody who's been involved in law enforcement will tell you, the most unreliable form of evidence is verbal, is eyewitness. Eyewitnesses are the most unreliable form of evidence. If you want reliable evidence, you need physical evidence. And here is something that has no physical evidence, and the very basis of the entire thing is something claimed by one person. And you can see how this thing has got all kinds of problems with it upon closer examination. To my knowledge, nobody's ever questioned Bobby Yar, but I think that maybe more work needs to be done on it. But this is my conclusion. When I looked at this book and I looked at these things, I thought to myself, this does not sound real. And what makes it even more dodgy is that it's based on one person's testimony. One person is the heart and soul of this thing. Whether the Germans went and shot some partisans for the bombings, you know, that is very possible. So I personally find the whole thing unbelievable. And also it seems to have come from a book written by somebody. It seems to have come from a book written by a Russian. And the Russians have also been playing notorious roles in creating some of this Holocaust lie. So a whole lot of dodgy stuff here, I must tell you. Lots of dodgy stuff, no physical evidence. And that to me says it all. These are my websites, historyreview.com, africancrisis.info, and white-shop.biz. This is my attempt to try and do some Jew-free trading and experimenting with the next level of stuff. So, thank you very much for listening. We'll be chatting again soon. Take care of yourselves.